Hello, this is Debbie with part two of the Decatur Herald and Review on Wednesday, June 22nd, 2016, beginning as we usually do with the death notices. Decatur Smith, D. Colleen. D. Colleen Smith, 99, of Decatur, passed away Monday, June 20th, at Symphony of Decatur. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, June 23rd, at Dawson Wyckoff West Wood Street Funeral Home. The family will receive friends for visitation beginning at 10 a.m. until service time. Burial will be at Graceland Cemetery. Memorials may be made to the South Shores Christian Church. Decatur, Gollenbeck, Ella Rosina. Ella Rosina Gollenbeck, 90, of Decatur, Illinois, passed away on Sunday, June 19, 2016, at Decatur Memorial Hospital. A graveside service to celebrate Ella's life will be held at 1 p.m. on Friday, June 24th, at Macon County Memorial Park Cemetery. Dawson and Wyckoff North Chapel is assisting the family with arrangements. Decatur, Hawes, William F. A life celebration service for William F. Hawes, 86, of Hot Springs Village, who died June 18, 2016, will be held Saturday, July 2nd, at 2 o'clock at Christ Lutheran Church in Hot Springs Village, with Pastor Warren Freiheit officiating. Decatur, Clark, Helen Lucille. Helen Lucille Clark, 89, of Decatur, died peacefully on Thursday, June 2, 2016, at Decatur Memorial Hospital. A memorial service to celebrate Helen's life will be held at 4 p.m. Sunday, June 26th, at the West Decatur Church of God, 4500 West Main Street, Decatur, with her son-in-law, the Reverend David Meador, officiating. Interment will be private at Macon County Memorial Park. The family will receive friends from 3 p.m. until the time of the service. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to the Decatur Memorial Hospital Hospice in Decatur. Arrangements have been entrusted to Tanzius Logan Funeral Service and Care in Decatur. Decatur, Moore, Rick A. Rick A. Moore, 57, Decatur, died Friday, June 17, 2016. Memorial service is 2 p.m. Saturday, Westminster Presbyterian Church. Arrangements by Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Memorials, Westminster Presbyterian Church. Neoga, Marshall. Dolores Marshall, 90, of Neoga, formerly of Bethany, passed away at 7:42 p.m. Monday, June 20th, in St. Anthony's Hospital, Effingham. Celebration of life services will be noon Thursday in the Reed Funeral Home, Sullivan, with Pastor Lloyd Simpson officiating. Visitation will be from 11 a.m. till service time. Burial will be in the Marrowbone Township Cemetery, Bethany. Memorials are suggested to Make-A-Wish Foundation. Dalton City, Smith, Tammy L. Tammy L. Smith, 51, of Dalton City, Illinois, passed away at 9:02 June 18th in Memorial Medical Center, Springfield. A service to celebrate Tammy's life will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, June 24th, at Dawson and Wyckoff Funeral Home, Mount Zion, Illinois. Burial will be at Mount Gilead Cemetery, Decatur, Illinois. The family will receive friends for visitation from 5 p.m. till 7 p.m. Thursday evening at the funeral home. Memorials may be made to the American Diabetes Association. Shelbyville, Hammond, J. Donald. J. Donald Hammond, 66, of Shelby, died at 10:40 a.m. Monday, June 20, 2016, in his residence. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. Sunday, June 26, 2016, in Howanyaki Funeral Home, Shelbyville, Illinois. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 Saturday in the funeral home. Burial will be in the Glenwood Cemetery, Shelbyville. Memorials may be given to the Upward Sports Program for boys and girls at the First Church of the Nazarene in Shelbyville. Bement, Sumer, Catherine Elaine. Catherine Elaine Scroggins, Sumer, 73, of Bement, Illinois, passed away 4:24 p.m. June 20, 2016, at her family residence, Bement, surrounded by her family. Celebration of Life services for John and Catherine Sumer will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, June 25th, at the Bement United Methodist Church with Pastor Lenny Sumer officiating. Visitation will be from 10 a.m. on Saturday till service time of 10:30 a.m. Burial will follow at the Bement Township Cemetery. Calvert Funeral Home DeLand assisted the family with cremation rites. Memorials may be directed to the Catherine Sumer Memorial Fund. And that completes the obituaries for June 22nd as printed in the Decatur and Herald Review, Decatur Herald and Review edition. Continuing, state and nation. Trump campaign appears short on donations. Trump's campaign spends $6 million with Trump companies. Washington, D.C., AP. Donald Trump is one of the wealthiest people to ever run for president, but his campaign appears to be flat broke. What's more, fundraising reports show he's used about $6 million in campaign money to pay his own companies and family members. The billionaire businessman's financial woes were enough to inspire the mocking Twitter hashtag TrumpSupport on Tuesday, and far more seriously, give already reluctant donors a fresh batch of reasons to withhold their money. Trump's campaign expenses are hardly inspiring confidence among people whose money he's pursuing. The spending includes $423,000 May payment to Mar-a-Lago, the private club in Florida that serves as a vacation home, and enough Trump-branded bottled water to fill a bathtub. Democratic rival Hillary Clinton ribbed Trump on Tuesday, tweeting to followers, "What is Trump spending his meager campaign resources on?" Why? Himself, of course. A presidential campaign is expensive, about $1 billion in recent years. That money pays for crucial candidate outreach, including costly television advertising, and identifying, persuading, and getting voters to the polls in November. Next article. Plane lands at South Pole in daring medical rescue. This is also out of DCAP. After flying through dangerous dark and cold, a rescue plane landed Tuesday at the South Pole to evacuate a sick worker from a remote U.S. science station, federal officials said. The plane arrived at the South Pole after a daring 1,500-mile, 9-hour trip from a British base on the Antarctic Peninsula, according to the National Science Foundation, which runs the polar outpost. The plane's crew, a pilot, co-pilot, flight engineer, and medical worker, will rest and wait for at least 10 hours. Then, if weather conditions are favorable, the plane will refuel and return to Rothera, said agency spokesman Peter West. After that, the sick worker will be taken out of Antarctica for treatment. It went all according to plan, West said, from Arlington, Virginia. A second worker is also ill, but officials have yet to decide whether that patient will also fly out, West said. The Science Foundation will not identify the workers who are employees of Lockheed Martin, which handles logistics at the station, nor their medical conditions. There have been three emergency evacuations from the Amundsen Scott station since 1999. Workers at the South Pole station are isolated from February through October, the coldest and darkest months when it's too risky for routine flights. The latest mission is pushing the limits of what is acceptable, said Tim Stockings, operation director at the British Antarctic Survey in London. He said, being prepared is key. The air in Antarctica are unforgiving environments and punishes any slackness very hard, Stocking said. If you're complacent, it will bite you. Things can change very quickly down there with ice from clouds, high winds, and snow, he said. The first day of winter in the southern hemisphere was Monday. The sun will not rise at the South Pole till the first day of spring in September. A South Pole webcam showed the station in the distance during the landing. There were some light because of a full moon and the ability of the camera to operate on low light, West said. It is still pitch dark, he said. The NSF decided last week to mount the rescue operation because one staffer needed medical care that can't be provided there. The station has a doctor, a physician's assistant, and is connected to doctors in the U.S. For consults, West said, there are 48 people, 39 men and 9 women, at the station. The temperature Tuesday afternoon at the South Pole station was minus 60 Celsius, with a wind chill that makes it feel like minus 108. minus 78 Celsius, according to the Science Foundation's weather station and webcam. The extreme cold affects a lot of things on planes, including fuel, which needs to be warmed before takeoff, batteries, and hydraulics, West said. The Twin Otter can fly in temperatures as low as minus 103, minus 75 degrees Celsius, he said. The 1999 flight, which was done in Antarctica spring in Antarctic spring with slightly better conditions, rescued the station's doctor, Jerry Nelson, who had breast cancer and had been treating herself. Rescues were done in 2001 and 2003, both for gallbladder problems. Scientists have had a station at the South Pole since 1911. It does astronomy, physics, and environmental science with telescopes, seismographs, and instruments that monitor the atmosphere. The foundation runs two other science stations in the Antarctic. End of that article. Out of Springfield, Senator seeks ban on bobcat trapping and pelt sales. By Dan Petrella, the H&R Springfield Bureau Chief. A state senator from suburban Chicago plans to move forward with a bill that would ban the trapping of bobcats and sale of their pelts ahead of the state's first legal hunting season for the once-threatened species in more than 90 years. State Senator Don Harmon, Democrat, Oak Park, said he was holding his bill because he'd reached an agreement with Illinois Department of Natural Resources that would have reduced the number of permits available for hunting and trapping the small wildcats and further restricted where they could be hunted. But he said Department Director Wayne Rosenthal walked away from the agreement for reasons unknown to me. Harmon now plans to advance his legislation. Under DNR rules, only 500 permits will be issued for the 2016-17 bobcat hunting and trapping season, and no one will be allowed to take more than one bobcat per season. Harmon said allowing trapping would make those rules difficult to enforce. We are proposing a very small number of permits, relatively speaking, according to the department, he said, and with trapping, there's no way to gauge how many animals you might take. If you set a half a dozen traps and you have a permit for only one bobcat, what happens if you take two? Harmon said he'd like to ban the sale of bobcat pelts because proponents arguing that allowing the species to be hunted was about controlling a growing population that was becoming a nuisance, not trophy hunting or pelt sales. I've gotten conflicting information about that since, he said. There appears to be some value to the pelts, and there appears to be a great deal of interest in trophy hunting. DNR opposes the bill because it said limiting bobcat hunting is an important tool for population control. The recovery of the bobcat population in Illinois is a conservation success story for everyone, spokesman Chris Young wrote in an email. Management of bobcats through regulated hunting and trapping is the next step in long-term conservation, and proposed levels of take are considered non-detrimental to the long-term viability of Illinois' bobcat population. The sale of bobcat pelts is regulated under federal law, Young added. The department said it's moving forward with rules as proposed because the senator didn't uphold his part of the agreement. He had agreed to advance a bill that would do away with registration requirements for small boats, which would save money, according to DNR. The department begrudgingly made a deal, which the senator did not hold up his end of the bargain, said Jason Heffley, Rosenthal's chief of staff. That should be no surprise on the senator's part that we filed the rules we filed. Hunting and trapping of bobcats in Illinois was banned in 1972, and the cats were placed on the state's first threatened species list in 1977. The species was removed from the list in 1999. And the last article on this page is national. Hundreds of new evacuations across West as wildfires surge. Los Angeles AP. Surging wildfires on Tuesday forced new evacuations of hundreds of homes across the West while firefighters worked to beat back a pair of huge adjacent blazes looming over suburban Los Angeles. For the U.S.-Mexico border southeast of San Diego, a two-day-old 12-square-mile wildfire took a large leap and forced the evacuation of about 600 homes and more than 1,500 people in the community of Lake Morena Village. Previously, only 75 people had evacuated from that fire. In Utah, officials have evacuated about 100 homes from a mountain town in the southwest of the state as a wildfire less than a mile away is moving down a rocky slope toward the community of Pine Valley. The blaze is less than a square mile, but moving dangerously close to homes in difficult terrain, officials said. In Southern California, two adjacent fires in the San Gabriel Mountains, 20 miles northeast of Los Angeles, burned out of control but had not destroyed any homes. Well, their combined size grew to more than 8 square miles. About 770 homes in the foothill city of Duarte were under evacuation orders, and residents of Bradbury and Monrovia, just to the west, were urged to be ready to leave immediately if given the word. At 4 a.m., wind shifts started bringing the fire down the mountain, but a helicopter making nighttime water drops slowed the advance. Significant progress, however, was made overnight in the east side of Duarte, where flames creeped down to the bottom of slopes behind homes and firefighters extinguished them. The two fires erupted separately Monday and scared homeowners before burning mostly away from the cities. Charles Downing, out of breath and with his shirt off because of the heat, said he was first smelled the fire and felt heat, ran outside of his house, and was astonished by the size and nearness of the flames. I came running over just to look, and it was 15 to 20 feet in the air, Downing told reporters. By the time I came back and told my grandma and my kids to get in the car, it was right by the car. He and two neighbors sprayed the flames with their yard hoses until firefighters arrived minutes later. Two towering columns of smoke rose from the mountain range, reminiscent of a 2009 fire that scorched 250 square miles of the Angeles National Forest as it burned for weeks. Elsewhere, crews made progress against a week-old blaze in rugged coastal mountains west of Santa Barbara, boosting containment to 70%. About 270 homes and other buildings were threatened by the blaze, which has charred more than 12 square miles since Wednesday. Authorities plan to begin lifting mandatory evacuations there on Wednesday. Other blazes burned wide swaths across Arizona and New Mexico, where firefighters also face blistering heat. In New Mexico, a 28-square-mile fire that erupted last week and destroyed 24 homes in the mountains south of Albuquerque showed signs of slowing down. Higher humidity has allowed crews to strengthen lines, and some evacuees would be allowed to return home on Tuesday. In eastern Arizona, a fire doubled to nearly 42 square miles and led officials to warn a community of 300 residents to prepare to evacuate. The blaze on the Fort Apache Indian Reservation was not moving quickly toward the community of Cedar Creek because of sparse vegetation and shifting winds. End of that article. On page A6, the last two articles for Nation/World. U.S. led coalition says only one-third of Fallujah cleared of IS. Baghdad, AP, only a third of Fallujah has been cleared of Islamic State militants, the U.S.-led coalition said Tuesday, days after the Iraqi government declared victory in the city west of Baghdad, which was held by extremists for more than 2 years. Other parts of the city are contested, said U.S. Army Colonel Christopher Garver, the Baghdad-based spokesman for the coalition, with clashes underway between Iraqi forces and IS fighters. Most of the cleared terrain is the south of the city, and clearing operations continue outward from the city center, Garber added. Iraqi forces pushed into the center of Fallujah on Friday, retaking government complex and the central hospital. That evening, Brigadier General Haider Obaidi, with Iraq's special forces, told the Associated Press his troops controlled 80% of the city. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi said Friday that Fallujah had returned to the embrace of the nation and that remaining IS pockets would be cleaned out within hours. But in recent days, there have been persistent clashes between Iraqi forces and IS fighters holed up in dense residential neighborhoods along the city's northern edge. What looks like is an IS defensive belt around the city with not as stiff defense inside. Okay, do that again. What it looks like is a defensive belt around the city with not as stiff defenses inside, Garber said, explaining that as Iraqi forces move out from the city center, they may encounter additional pockets of stiff resistance. That could be their toughest fighting, Garber added. Iraqi commanders on the ground say their forces continue to make progress and have killed hundreds of militants. Iraqi special forces led by U.S.-led airstrikes have taken control of the neighborhoods of Al-Shurta and Al-Jughafi, al-Obeidi told the AP on Tuesday. He said Iraqi military engineers were clearing the streets and buildings of leftover bombs. The top special forces commander for the Fallujah operation told local Al-Sumeria TV late Monday that the offensive killed 2,500 IS fighters. Lieutenant General Abdul Wahab al-Sadi offered no evidence to back up his claim. Iraqi troops have not disclosed their losses in Fallujah, though the Islamic State group claims to have killed dozens. The operation has fueled an exodus of thousands of families, overwhelming camps for the displaced run by the government and aid groups. The UN Refugee Agency said Tuesday that more than 85,000 people have fled Fallujah and the surrounding areas since the offensive began. UNHCR spokeswoman Ariana Rumri said she expected that thousands more could still be planning to leave the city and appealed for more aid donations. The U.S. State Department announced an additional $20 million to aid in UNHCR response to appeal for emergency needs in Fallujah. This will be part of a larger package of humanitarian assistance that will be announced later this year, so there's more aid coming, State Department spokesman John Kirby said. Since 2014, the U.S. has sent more than $778 million in humanitarian aid to Iraq, according to the State Department. Since August 2014, it has spent $7.5 billion on operation against IS in both Iraq and Syria, according to the Pentagon. Fallujah is the last IS bastion in the sprawling Anbar province. IS still controls pockets of territory in Iraq's north and south, including Mosul, the country's second largest city. More than 3.4 million Iraqis have fled their homes since IS swept across northern and western Iraq in the summer of 2014, according to UN figures. More than 40% of the displaced are from Anbar province. A series of attacks in and around Baghdad, including one targeting anti-IS Sunni fighters, killed at least 12 people and wounded 42 others on Tuesday, police and health officials said on condition of anonymity, as they were not authorized to release information. No group has claimed responsibility for the attacks, but they bore the hallmarks of IS. The near-daily attacks are seen by Iraqi officials as an attempt to divert security forces' attention from the front lines. And the second article on the Nation World page is Fake Bomb Sparks Alert at Belgium Mall, from AP Brussels. A man wearing a fake explosive belt filled with salt and cookies sparked a major security alert in Brussels in an emergency meeting of key government ministers Tuesday by claiming he would be blown up outside a shopping center. Police said the man claimed to have been abducted and dropped off at the downtown City 2 complex. He said the suicide belt would be detonated remotely, prompting a response that highlighted the state of frayed nerves among the security services and government. The suspect later admitted he'd made the whole story up. Belgium has been on at least its second highest security alert level for about 8 months since the November 13th massacres in Paris that killed 130 people. On March 22nd, suicide attacks on the Brussels underground and airport killed 32 people and injured hundreds. Extra police and military have been mobilized, guarding major buildings, nuclear plants, and parts of the transport network. Police searched the home of the mother of the suspect, a man in his 20s, identified in official documents only as JB. Finding materials that had apparently been used to make the fake belt, Brussels prosecutor Rime Guiche said in a statement. Confronted with this information, J.B. admitted falsifying his story. He said he had given police the license plate of a car he spotted in the street. The driver of the vehicle was questioned and quickly released, Kasich said. Prosecutors said J.B., who'd been recently informed... All right, over again, because we're missing some words here. Prosecutor said J.B., who had recently informed police that he'd been enlisted to join the Islamic State extremist group in Syria, was known to police and is thought to have had psychiatric problems. He has been remanded into custody over the hoax, and a psychological assessment has been ordered. Straight after the pre-dawn alert, Prime Minister Charles Michel changed his morning program and a meeting of the Belgian Crisis Center was called. The situation is now under control. The security services remain extremely vigilant, Michael said in a statement. Crisis Center spokesman Peter Martins said the nation's security alert was not changed. That level and the measures accompanying it is already high. The situation this morning has no impact on the existing measures. At the scene, police in hoods and military wearing helmets were seen patrolling around at least one major entry to the City 2 shopping center, and the demining squad was also called. Some entries to the subway station were blocked and underground traffic disrupted. The alert recalled an incident in Paris in January when police shot to death a man wearing a fake explosive vest and carrying a butcher knife as he threatened officers. The man carried a document with an emblem of the Islamic State group, but his family in Tunisia insisted he was no extremist. Belgium had been particularly on edge over the past few weeks following a series of arrests and police raids linked to the suspected terror attacks. Over the weekend, authorities charged three men with terror-related crimes after 2 days of raids and detention of 40 people in a major investigation, which they said required immediate intervention. Unconfirmed media reports suggested that a shopping complex, an American fast food chain, and police were among the possible targets. Security was visibly higher immediately after the report surfaced, although police denied it was boosted in response to the news. Meanwhile, Belgian investigators searched seven homes Tuesday in the probe into an attempted attack last year on a high-speed train from Amsterdam to Paris that was thwarted by three American passengers. No one was detained, and no weapons or explosives were among the materials seized in searches in central Brussels, the Molenbeek Saint-Jean neighborhood, Antwerp, and Kokelenburg, the federal prosecutor's office said in the statement. Belgian authorities detained six people Monday in the investigation into that attack. End of that article. Continuing to the money section as we close part two for June 22, 2016. National and international. Feds will use tax penalty data to find uninsured millennials. Fort Lauderdale, AP. With time running out for the Obama administration to prove the success of the Affordable Care Act, officials are aggressively targeting a group that could help turn things around, young people. Federal health officials announced Tuesday they will comb tax records to find the 18 to 34-year-olds who paid the penalties stipulated under President Barack Obama's Health Care Act for not buying health insurance and reach out to them directly with emails to urge them to avoid even higher penalties scheduled for this year. They also plan to heavily advertise the enrollment campaign, including promotion with trendy ride-sharing service Lyft, to offer discounted rides to enrollment events. Insurance companies need robust enrollment of healthy young people to balance the costs of caring for the older, sicker adults who signed up in droves for insurance under so-called Obamacare. The overhaul has been a financial drain for many companies entering their fourth year of the law. They've repeatedly said they were caught off guard by the conditions of initial enrollees who were sicker and required more services than insurers anticipated. Roughly 11.4 million millennials were eligible for coverage in the federal marketplace, according to the 2013 data from Kaiser Family Foundation. Federal health officials said only 28% of the enrollees in 2016 were from that age group. We'll finish here quickly with businesses recognized for beautification efforts. This is Local by Chris Lisvardi. Decatur, Coffee Connection is among the businesses in Decatur that keep making its property look beautiful a top priority. In the past few years, the business has become a model forever. for others. It was recognized Tuesday with the Speed Loop Continued Excellence Award as part of the Beautify Decatur Coalition's annual Let's Keep Decatur and Macon County Beautiful contest. End of that article. End of part two, June 22nd, 2016, Decatur Herald and Review.